Brooklyn's Radio. Loving events in Surrey.
This is Dave Demetus, and I spent a day at Brooklyn's Museum in Surrey. Brooklyn's Museum is on the grounds of the Brooklyn's Racetrack, built in 1907, the first such racetrack in Britain. Brooklyn's is called the birthplace of British motorsport and aviation, and many of the original buildings, now listed buildings, are still in use, and so is part of the original track. The 1920s and 30s were groundbreaking times at Brooklyn's, when record times were being set and broken by Malcolm Campbell, John Cobb, and others, in such magnificently crafted machines as Napier, Delage, Mercedes, Bentley, and Bugatti. It was at Brooklyn's that A.V. Rowe made pioneering powered flight trials, with his first full-sized airplane in 1908. Here that Tommy Sopwith developed and flew the Sopwith Pup and Sopwith Camel, and here too that the Hawker Hurricane and Vickers Wellington were built before and during World War II. It was at Brooklyn's that A.V. Rowe made pioneering powered flights with his first full-sized airplane in 1908. Here that Tommy Sopwith developed and flew the Sopwith Pup and Camel, and here too that the Hawker Hurricane and Vickers Wellington were built before and during World War II. The post-war years were distinguished by the achievements of the Vickers, later BAC and finally British Aerospace Factory, which produced a successful family of civil and military aircraft, including the Viscount and VC-10 airliners, and contributed significantly to the design and manufacture of Concorde. There is so much to see at Brooklyn's, from penny farthing bikes to the bus museum to the Concorde Expo. Experience on board the 6th Concorde ever made. It's a great day out, and I will guide you with the help of some of the 400 volunteers of Brooklyn's. We'll hear from Brent about the Napier Railton, a 24-litre racing car that set speed records, and from David about the Wellington bomber recovered from Loch Ness and now fully restored, and from John about the Sultan of Oman's private DC-10, complete with every luxury of the day, to name but a few. Sitting on these amazing aircraft, talking with the expert volunteers, brings the history of Brooklyn's alive. Go to Brooklyn's and see for yourself. But now let's listen to these experts as I wander around Brooklyn's Museum.
Right, I'm with Brent. Now, standing in front of a AC sociable three-wheeler. This is a 1910 made by AC, and it strikes me as sort of like it's like a fat sidecar with an engine.
Yes, I guess it probably was. The interesting thing about these old cars is that even in 1910, they hadn't actually got a steering wheel fitted to most of them. So you can look in there, you can see they were tiller steering. And an awful lot of the cars then did use tiller steering.
So it's like a boat?
Kind of, yes. So you just pull and push the lever to turn the front wheels.
I guess in the days of this vehicle, people were still trying to figure out what cars should look like and how they should operate.
Yeah, I think they were. I mean, it wasn't that long, I guess, after the horse and cart. So the very early cars did tend to look more like the carts that normally horse-drawn. So they still hadn't completely evolved into the cars that we know today.
Yeah, now the vehicle beside this one is a Peugeot Voiture 1900, so it's a bit older, but it looks a lot more like what you'd call a vintage car, except the seat at the front actually points backwards.
Yes, it does, and I think there were quite a few cars in those days that did that, but in fact, interestingly, with this one, you can swing that, taped up, but that would normally swing over, so you could, in fact, sit facing forward just with your feet dangling down here.
So it is like a horse and carriage, isn't it, without the horse at the front?
That's right. That's correct. Yes. Yeah. So, as you say, normally you would have a horse at the front of the carriage, and it was very much like that.
Great. Thanks very much. I'm with Brian Bastrett in the Jackson Shed. Yes. Now, what made you become a volunteer, Brian?
I became a volunteer because I used to work here.
Oh, yeah? Doing what exactly? The same thing, or...?
No, I was a draftsman here originally, and I finished up my time here in the clubhouse as a draftsman in early 60s. This shop then was filled with experimental stuff, which was being done under Barnes Wallace, who was in charge of the research in the clubhouse.
Barnes Wallace worked here after the war. What sort of stuff was he working on, or was that a different department?
At that time, he'd been doing swallow work. If you remember the Swallow, it was a moving wing aircraft for supersonic, with the wings back, and so the wings came forward to land like the Tornado. And he had all sorts of other projects he would be dabbling around in at the time. He always tried to make a simple solution to anything.
He was an incredible man, wasn't he? So now this shed is full of Formula One racing cars?
Yes. Well, it tries to show a history of Formula One cars. At one end, we have what was the original Bluebird.
And Malcolm McDonald.
Yes. And next to it, At the moment, it's in the other, is the Delage. And next to that is a Duesenberg that raced here. Then we have the Halford, which also raced in the first Grand Prix here. Because the first two British Grand Prix were run here.
When was that?
26, 27. And then if you go along the shop from one end to the other, we get approximately more modern as we go along. They're not always in the right places because cars are in and out all the time. And they're not all Grand Prix cars, but they are, does give a history of the development of the car.
Yeah, and that leads right up to the final one, which is a, is that a McLaren on the end?
Down this side, it's the Wolf. The McLaren is used for a simulator. We have a second McLaren. Both those are actually show cars. The second McLaren we allow children to sit in, because it's always a bit of an excitement for them.
What's the large silver one in front of me there?
Ah.
It looks like it's not in the right age range,
either. It's not in the right age. It's the Razor Blade, which is an Aston Martin special, which was also built by Halford. Halford himself worked at Ricardo's down at Shoreham, and having worked there, he was subcontracted to de Havilland's and developed their aero engines. After the war, he joined de Havilland's and built their jet engines. So he was quite a clever little man.
Yeah. Now, you clearly love these cars, you guys, so that's why you volunteer here?
No, I think I volunteered originally because I'd worked here. I knew the place. I knew the hangar. I'd worked there. And it all brings back memories over the years. So, although some of the pieces aren't the same, the other shed across the way, I can remember part of it as being a restaurant or canteen and a workshop. There used to be a workshop in front of the clubhouse, which is gone. But I really came here because I enjoyed the place when I worked here, and it brings back memories.
That's really nice, and presumably the camaraderie as well.
Yes, because even now there are people here who worked when I did. There's at least one other I know of who was an apprentice with me. So it's long history for us.
How many hours a week do you do, Brian?
I do 2 days a week. I do a Monday and a Thursday. The Monday seems to be a bit erratic because I have other things that happen on a Monday, but I'm pretty regular on a Thursday, and I've done that now. This is my 15th year as a volunteer.
So you worked here since the 60s, and then you've been volunteering for 15 years?
Yes, yes. When I worked here, I was an apprentice. I did 11 years here then and finished in 65, when things looked very bad for the aircraft industry.
And this place has changed just a little bit in that time.
Yes, but not a lot, these buildings around here. The floor's tiled now, where it was concrete, and this sort of thing's happened. And it's been painted. I mean, when this was a workshop, you wouldn't have had white paint on the ceiling. It would have all been bare wood, and that was it. And because it was a workshop, so you don't bother to paint the inside of a workshop. All, if you go to your local garage, it's just the same now, isn't it?
Great. Thank you very much. A pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much indeed.
I'm here with Michael Sams. Tell me, what is it like being a volunteer here?
This is a wonderful, wonderful place to be a volunteer. Now, a lot of the people who come here have retired recently or a few years ago.
And the other thing, on a day-to-day basis, I describe this as the biggest toy box in Surrey.
That's a lovely description.
Well, it is. Times Educational Supplement once described it as a wonderfully higgledy-piggledy place, because although there is arrangement of the exhibits in the sheds and in the aeroplanes, it's a place where you walk round a corner and there's something unexpected catching you. It's a bit of a serendipity place. And from that point of view, being a volunteer one of the thrills about this place is you do not know who is going to walk through the door today, and you can get the most wonderful people. I'll tell you a little anecdote. It was a November afternoon, due to close at 4. It was grey, misty, very atmospheric. And at 3:30, I had a message. Could I show this American lady to Vickers Wellington in the hangar? So I picked up this lady. She was about 5'0" in a silver shell suit. And I said, I'm glad you've come to the museum. How far have you come? I come from Los Angeles. Oh, really? Well, if you don't mind me asking, what brings an American lady of a certain age all the way from Los Angeles to look at a British World War II bomber? I was a sonar operation and I found it.
Very good, yeah. Very good.
So you just do not know who is going to come through here. We get the most interesting people. And one of the policies of the museum is that the volunteers are expected to be proactive. Although sometimes we take a weight of our feet and sit down, we don't sit in a corner waiting to be asked questions. We are part of the entertainment. We go up and engage the visitors in conversation, make them welcome, chat to them, and explain things. And if you or any of your listeners check Brooklyn's Museum on TripAdvisor, a lot of the TripAdvisor comments are the volunteers were so friendly and knowledgeable. But we come here for different motivations. Some have been in the aircraft industry, some have been in the motor industry, some have been in nothing like that at all. They just come here because they're petrol heads or because they've just got a genuine interest. I came here because of the motorcycles. But I got wrapped up with the interest in the cars, got wrapped up with the aeroplanes, got wrapped up with Concorde, got wrapped up with the school tours and the school party visits. And it is just such a fascinating place.
Well, how many volunteers are there roughly altogether? I know it's different each day.
You must remember that the volunteers are not all face-to-face with the public. Mm. There are volunteers tucked away doing work on archives and the library. There are volunteers doing the car rides, but the total volunteer force is about 400.
400?
400.
Wow. People who all love this place.
Yes, we do. And it's a mixture of ages. There are some people who manage to squeeze it in with going to work as well, although a lot of us are ladies and gentlemen of advanced youth. We don't do old here. We've just been young longer than you have.
Very good. Been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Okay.
Right, I'm on the flight deck of VC-10 with John Hardy.
Hello.
Right, do tell me about this aircraft.
Well, this aeroplane was built here at Brooklands in 1964 for British United Airways, and they operated it as an airliner for 10 years, and then the Sultan of Oman bought it off them and had it converted into this VIP interior that... We've got a very nice stateroom and two bedrooms, and the rear cabin was for his entourage. And the Sultan operated it through the Omani Royal Flight for until 1987, when it had to be grounded because it wasn't really meeting the latest noise regulations for the international airports. So he couldn't fly into Heathrow or Paris and places like that without paying a noise violation fine. But that's how we got it back, because he didn't want to see it scrapped and turned into Coke cans, so he gave it to the museum. So it flew in us in 1987, and it's been here ever since. It was given as a gift. And that's the brief history of it, really.
And I can see you've got power turned on at the moment. There's various lights on the dials and things on the dashboard.
Yes, that's another story, because these aircraft are actually 115 volts, 400 hertz. And this has had to be modified to take the British mains voltage, which is 240 volts, 50 hertz. And so there's a lot of rewiring and things like that to get things going. It's the only way we could get power to without having a ground power unit running all the time, which are expensive to buy and very expensive to operate because they're diesel powered. And so, yeah, it's the best thing we could have done, really. I say we, it was before I became a volunteer that it was all done. It's all done in about 1988. So
how long have you been a volunteer then, John?
It's not far off 15 years now. I've got my 10-year badge and... So it'll be 15 years in a couple of years' time, God being willing.
Now, I noticed there's four seats on the flight deck here, which to me seems a little bit unusual.
Over here, for the navigator. It was a four-man crew in the early days, and the navigator used to have a periscopic sextant that went through the roof here, and he had to navigate by the stars. He had another device back there called Loran. And also we had Doppler, which gave you drift angle and ground speed, and had a little Doppler computer so you could put the tracks and distances in, as I remember. And then, of course, the big step forward was when, after the Americans had been to the moon, they went with one inertial navigation system, as I remember, and we ended up with three on most airliners, and that did away with the navigator in the mid-70s. So then it was just two pilots and a flight engineer. And now, of course, on the modern digital aeroplanes, there's no flight engineer, because as you can see, this is virtually totally analog. You've got a gauge and a switch for everything, whereas now you do everything through flight management computers. So it's a totally different concept of flying, really. But the basics are still the same.
And what's your background before joining as a volunteer, John?
Oh, well, I've been in aviation all my life. I started as an apprentice with de Havilland's when I was 15. And after I'd finished my apprenticeship, I'd managed to get my aircraft maintenance engineer's licenses. And I went and worked in the West Indies for a little airline called LIAT and gained experience of maintenance and looking after aeroplanes. And then I joined BOAC as a cadet flight engineer in 68 and stayed with BA until I retired in 1955. And then I went to Virgin Atlantic for just under 5 years on their 747s. And I was on these VC-10s for several years when I first started, before going on to jumbos. So, yeah, that's a brief potted history.
I noticed in the sign it said only 54 of these VC-10s were made.
It wasn't really a commercial success. There's a number of reasons, really. One, this aeroplane was over-engineered. It was too well made. This was like a Rolls-Royce, whereas a Boeing 707 was like a Ford. And the airlines want the cheapest option, and they always went for the Ford. So this only sold, as you say, 54, and the Boeing 707 sold nearly 2,000. But in fact, this made money for British Airways in the end on the Atlantic, because it was very, very popular with the North Americans through some very clever advertising. You might remember that the slogan... whisper across the Atlantic and fly a little VC tenderness. So it was very, very clever advertising. I think the advertising agent at the time was Saatchi & Saatchi, as I remember.
Never heard of them. Never heard of them.
A small company, yes. This thing that stopped the commercial VC-10s flying really was the noise regulations. But most of them had been retired by the mid-80s anyways. Only a few were still flying, Malawi and this one, really. And that's, as I said earlier on, that's how we ended up with this one here.
Courtesy of the Sultan Oman.
Yes, he's a very generous gentleman.
It's well appointed, this aircraft back here. Two bedrooms and plush seating and so on. He knew how to fly in style, didn't he?
He did. The only thing that's missing, in my opinion, is in the toilet there's no shower. He's got a toilet and a bidet, but no shower.
Oh, we'll have to tell him off for that one.
Yes. I'm sure on his latest one, he's got a 747-400. I'm sure he's got a shower on that.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much, Don. That's very interesting. Right, we're standing at the back of a Wellington bomber with Terry Marshall Allen this later. The famous Loch Ness Wellington.
Yes, the Americans were looking for the Loch Ness Monster. And they didn't find the Loch Ness Monster. They found the Wellington. That is a true story. Now, this had been in the lock for over 40 years. What happened about this one was the engine on the right had frozen up and they were only flying it on one engine. Now, you couldn't keep flying it on one engine. This plane was actually built here at Brooklands. So what they actually did was they flew it round the lock. They had five crew on it. Unfortunately, it was the rear gunner that lost his life. He got his parachute caught when he came out of it. So the pilot and navigator stayed on it, landed it on the lock. and then it floated to the bottom of the lock, so it went right down deep. And as I say, it had been in the lock for over 40 years. Now, we were lucky, they weren't, because it was in their lock and not in the sea, so it didn't soften the salt water. That is why most of this is genuine. Of course, they had to put it together. This was covered in Irish linen. The woman sewed it on, then covered it in dope, which would strengthen it. Unfortunate thing about it was, you've got to remember that when the people worked on these planes, same as the pilots, they were only 19, 20 and 21. Now, we get them in here now and they're in their 90s. But when the woman sewed the dope up, sewed it on, they covered it in dope, but they didn't realise what effect they would have with the dope afterwards. So when they come in here now, they still suffer from the dope effect. So that's why it's nice you come to Brooklands and see one. Now, there was over 11,000 of these built. Unfortunately, the ones that were left after the war, we're talking roughly about 54, because it's alley, and they're all broken up, and the alley was used. Barnes Wallace developed it for lightness and strength, and we had the pilots and the gunners that come here, and they tell you that it wasn't only the bullet holes going through it, it was also hailstones. So it shows you how thin it was.
You can see on this airplane here, part of it has got the outside shell, but a lot of it, you can see the aluminium geodesic design, which essentially is an awful lot of holes. So I can imagine the bullets would just go straight through. And
it did.
Hailstones as well.
And that is why a lot of the planes did survive, because there was nothing stopping the bullets, just the bullets just went through. Of course, it was the pilots and the gunners that took the hammer in. Needless to say, the rear gunner, to get in and out of that one is really hard. And also, they often said that when they came back from Germany, which was a four-hour flight, it was always the rear gunners that took the punishment. And they used to, believe it or not, have to hose them out to get them out the back when they got back.
Really?
Yeah, that is a true story. And this is why Brooklands is good, because you hear the stories from the pilots and the gunners that were actually on it. Unfortunate thing was with this plane, you've got a gunner in the front, you've got a gunner at the back, but you've got nothing underneath. So, of course, if anything came underneath it to shoot it, you couldn't do it. You know, that's the ones that suffered. So it's nice when you can actually say you've seen one.
Surprisingly long wingspan. It's larger than I expected.
It is. It is a long wingspan. I mean, they used to literally build the Wellingtons here at Brooklands, and they would take off from here. And they actually did one in 24 hours. What I say to people when they come in, when they say 24 hours, I say, yes, if you bought a wardrobe from Argus, you buy it in parts. So it makes it easier to say you assemble it. And that's how it would work.
And this was found in bottom of Loch Ness, and it must have taken ages to restore this beautiful aircraft.
Yes, it did. I mean, we literally got it up in bits. They were pretty rusty. They cleaned them up and put it all together. And it's nice, as I say, to think that we've actually got one back that was built here. So, you know, it is good. At the present, we've got it in the hangar. We are going to move it out of the hangar, because the hangar's coming down on the Wednesday, was it 3rd of September? We can have it all taken out, and we're lucky enough to have had the money through. We can have a hangar put over where the flight shed is over there, because the hangar was put here in 1940 as a temporary hangar for 7 years. So once we move it, we've then got the finishing straight back. So that's what the plans are.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. That's fascinating.
Is that right? I think I've told you most of it now, but it is good. When you work at Brooklands Museum, you get the interest in all that, and then you know why we get a lot of people come here, because you've got the history and heritage here.
And what is it makes you become a volunteer at Brooklands?
I retired. I am now 71. I found that when I came here as a volunteer, I was only doing 2 days. You get the enjoyment, you meet interesting people. And also, when you come to Brooklands, we talk to you, where you could go to another air museum, and you're lucky if they do. And that's why it's interesting when you talk to people.
Great. Thank you very much.
Next, I'm going for a ride in a vintage sports car around to the famous Test Hill, and up Test Hill, out onto the circuit banking for a little way, and then back down to the start point for the next passengers.
Hello, Chris. And what car are we sitting in, Chris?
It's a replica of a 1932 Model B Ford Roadster. but that's about as far as it gets because it's made out of all sorts of bits and pieces that we've assembled.
Right, and now you're going to do your best to terrify me as we race up Test Hill.
Of course.
Go for it! We're driving round to the base of Test Hill and getting set for a fast start up this steep hill.
Here we go. The racetrack, it was, as the name implies, was used for testing cars, but they also found it was enjoyable to see who could get to the top the quickest.
So, well, absolutely.
So now we're going to take a short cut out onto the old bank racetrack. You'll see it in a few moments. Okay, so this is one of the few sections of the racetrack that still exists. Just about used, but it's very, very bumpy. If you think of Brooklands as basically being an egg shape, we're at the pointy end of the egg, and this is about 28 feet high. The drivers used to get very near the top and occasionally over the top, and as there was no Armco barrier in those days, there were a few fatalities, but today we'll try not to achieve that.
So how steep is the banking?
When we're actually going along fairly near the top, we'll be at about 45 degrees.
Wow.
So you've got to imagine that we're doing about 120 miles an hour. Doing about 120 plus all the way along the top, 2¾ miles all the way around the track for a number of laps, and then finally ending up on the finishing straight, which is where we're approaching. The finishes usually take place in front of the clubhouse so that all the spectators can see them.
And we're just heading back into the paddock now. Now we're off the banking and heading back to the start point for the next passengers in a thrilling ride. And you're a volunteer here, Chris?
I'm a volunteer. I've been here for over 10 years doing this.
And you clearly love it.
It's great fun, and particularly good to see all the people enjoying themselves when they come to the museum.
On a beautiful sunny day like today.
Yes, hopefully we won't have any more rain as we did this morning, but it's nice and warm again now.
Great, thanks so much. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
I'm here with Chris Berry, the team leader for the motorcycle team. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
We're sitting in front of a beautiful ABC motorbike. Yeah. Tell me about this one, please.
Well, that was built here originally by... The company was based here at Brooklands originally.
Yeah.
Oh, Sopwith, that's right. It came from the Sopwith family originally, and they started building motorcycles after aircraft.
Are you restoring this one, or is this fully operational?
It's ready to go now. In fact, we've run it 2 or 3 times already. Yeah, it's done now. Yeah, as well as we're going to do it anyway.
The range of motorbikes that you have here, please.
Well, in the museum, we try to keep motorbikes on display that have some relevance to Brooklands, be it racing, riding, record breaking, whatever. We've got a couple of fairly modern bikes, but they're here because they have a legacy from the original. For instance, BSA, the original Gold Star was awarded to a BSA motorbike, and because they got the Gold Star for doing 100 miles an hour lap, they carried on using the Gold Star name and built loads of different models. But we do have a modern or modernish one, 1958 I think it is, which is a carry-on from the original Gold Star motorbike, yeah? Which was called an Empire Star in those days. It's years ago, but yeah.
Empire. What's the connection with Sopwith you mentioned?
Sopwith was an aircraft manufacturer here, had a factory here building aircraft back in the early 1900s. He was quite famous for all sorts of aircraft. There is a replica of one of his... Sopwith Camel round in the Wellington hangar, and he carried on making motorbikes for a while. I just he was based here, that's all. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Chris. Now I'm sitting with Ian Dabney, who restored this beautiful ABC bike in front of me. So tell me, what made you start on this?
Well, we were riding the bike and it was rather rattling a lot, so we thought we ought to look into it because it's a rather lovely and unusual bike. They were very advanced for their time, so we were trying to isolate the rattle, and in the end it required us to take the engine out, strip the engine right down to its basics, find what the problem was, which was a loose clutch, and some new bearings and bushes and various things in it, and rebuild it and put it back together, and now it's running fine.
Just sitting in front of it, it looks a very unusual design for an engine. What is different about this?
Right, well, there are several things that were quite advanced. The Greville Bradshaw, the person who designed it, was building and designing aircraft engines.
Yeah.
So he knew a lot of the principles of very powerful, very lightweight engines. So, in a sense, this layout is organised such it can get a lot of air across both cylinders rather than fore and aft, where the rear one wouldn't get the air. It's overhead valve, which for the time was very advanced. It's got automatic oiling. And actually, for its time, it's got a four-speed gearbox, which was virtually unheard of, and suspension. So, all in all, it took a lot of his experience from building aircraft engines and some racing motorbikes prior to the First World War and incorporated it in this design.
And did he carry on making bikes? Because I must admit, I don't know the name, maybe.
So. No, he this was built by Sopwiths, and then Sopwiths went into problems, and this stopped being built. It was licensed by a company called Gaume Rhône in France, and they carried on with them. He also built some engines, which you can see around Brooklands, which are called oil-cooled engines that were used by a variety of manufacturers. And, in fact, he carried on building engines of various kinds. I think he was involved in actually even some of the three-wheeled cars that were appearing at the time. So he had a long, long history of building engines that carried right through to the 50s.
Wow. Great. Thanks very much.
Pleasure to speak to you.
Right, I'm standing with Brent Chiswick in front of a beautiful, beautiful Napier Railton car. Good morning, Brent.
Good morning.
Now, do tell me about this beautiful car, please.
Well, it's one of the museum's pride and joy, this car, and it's one that I think everybody that knows a museum knows this car. It's a record holder, the lap record holder here, of 143 miles an hour, and one that the museum was fortunate enough to own in the late 90s.
How big's the engine on this thing? Because it looks enormous.
It is. It's a 24-litre aero engine.
An aero engine? Yep. Seriously?
It is, yeah. It's a Napier Lion engine that was designed back in 1917. It's a 12-cylinder, 24-litre.
Wow. I wonder if it's pretty quick. How fast did you say it goes?
Well, the lap record here at Brooklands was just over 143 miles an hour. But
when was that?
That was in 1937 that I did that. But also, it for a while held the record out in Bonneville at 155 miles an hour.
Oh, the Bonneville Salt Flats?
Yes, that's right, yes. That's a 24-hour endurance record that it did out there.
Wow. Now, what's your favourite vehicle? There's a lot of beautiful vehicles here. What's your favourite?
I've got a lot of favourites, actually. I'm rather fond of this little Delage, which is the one that won the 1926 British Grand Prix that was held at Brooklands. That's a lovely little car.
Now, that looks like a little bit like a modern-day Morgan.
Yeah, kind of. It's a lot smaller than something like the Railton, which was designed specifically for endurance racing. But that one was more a small, nippy, if you like, Grand Prix car.
So it's more practical. And it was a popular racing car again?
It was, yes. It was a popular racing car. There were a lot of Delages built in that period. But this one was a lovely little 1.5-litre Grand Prix car.
And how fast could that go?
I don't know. At the moment, it won't go very fast at all because the engine's not in it. But I don't know what sort of speed that one did, but all I know is it won the 26 British Grand Prix here.
This Napier Railton, I should have asked, because the petrol tank on this thing must be enormous. What's the miles to the gallon, sort of like one or two, something like that?
I believe it's around two, when it was racing, it was around 2 miles to the gallon.
2 miles to the gallon?
Yeah, something like
that. Whoa. Wouldn't want to be responsible for that.
No.
Great, well, thank you very much.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
I'm with Arthur Bucklehurst, and I'm sitting in a BAC 111 airplane, and I'm sitting in the pilot seat, which is quite fun. Hello, Arthur.
How would you do?
Now, do tell me about this airplane, please.
Well, basically, this is one of several aeroplanes built mostly down at Herne, but 13 of which were built here when Herne couldn't actually cope with the numbers that were demanded. Initially, it was a winner because it sold like hotcakes in America, but unfortunately the Americans caught up fast because they then built the DC-9, which is a Chinese copy of this aeroplane with engines at the back, and also the 737, which is still being built to this very day. And so far they've built about 10,000 of them. We built 244.
There you did, you overtaken that, didn't you?
Yeah. So anyway, there, but for the grace of God. But in fact, it was a beautiful aeroplane, and it really did, when it first was built, overcome the market as being an aircraft that was better than anything else on the market.
So does it have special features, or is it just more advanced generally?
Well, one of the special features was that it was one of the early aeroplanes fitted with the engines at the back. There was another aeroplane made by the French, Caravelle, that had engines at the back, but that had a lot of English fitments on board anyway. So we were proud of the fact that we helped the French with their Caravelle, which was a competitive aeroplane to this one.
Now, you're another volunteer here, so are you one of the many who used to work here and then couldn't leave the place and became a volunteer?
I was an apprentice here in the 50s, and during that time they were building lots of different aeroplanes, Viscounts, Valiants, the early days of the Vanguard, and also the VC-10. I started as an apprentice, and I finished up in the design office working on VC-10s. And then I left here in 61 and went elsewhere.
And now you're back as a volunteer?
I'm back here as a volunteer. And it's rather sad to see this place as it is now, from, about 350, 400 acres, down to about 30 acres, right in the corner.
So it was a huge manufacturing area when you used to work here?
Most definitely. When I was working here, there must have been 14, 15,000 people. We're talking 50s technology now, when we actually snitched the market with the Viscount over there, and really there was nothing else to touch that at the time.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right, I'm sitting with Mike Hawes on Viscount. Do tell me about this aircraft, please.
Good afternoon. This aircraft was actually built here at Brooklands in 1958, one of 222. The remaining 222 were built down at Herne in Bournemouth. It spent most of its life with BEA, then it went to Wales for a while, came back and was merged as British Airways, and the last 3 years of its life, it's as you see it now, which is British Air Ferries, which was Freddie Laker.
Oh, I remember Freddie Laker, dirt cheap airfares.
You're quite right, yes. He made his money actually from the Berlin Airlift originally, then he started off SkyTrain, Laker Airways, British United Airways, but his system here was to reduce legroom to get more people in, quick release seating system, so you could have the seats out within 15 minutes and you could carry 15 tonnes of soft cargo. So if you didn't have passengers, you got cargo, so you can keep flying, earning money on that. And then unfortunately when Freddie died, the airline gradually ceased to exist and it's come back to live with us here.
And British Airways had a hand in ending Freddie Laker as well, I remember.
Yes, British Airways were not over keen on anybody matching them. You had the modern conflict with Virgin Atlantic, but he tried to turn the bankers against Freddie. But Freddie was sensible in the sense he never used his own money. So he may have business-wise gone bankrupt, but he wasn't bankrupt financially himself. He lived a very nice life in the Bahamas. I dealt with him at Heathrow. Charming guy, but as for sort of reducing legroom, I think that's the only thing we've got against him. Taking 2 inches off your legroom on this aircraft was the thin end of the wedge, but without Freddie, you wouldn't have had the cheap airlines that you've got now.
Yeah, now, the thing that strikes me sitting on this airplane is that it's very modern in design and inside, but modern normal aircraft now has tiny windows. This has absolutely enormous windows.
Yes, they have big windows, largest window any commercial airliner, mainly for a reason you'd probably never think of in a month of Sundays, is it doesn't fly over 30,000 feet, so physically it can withstand the pressure on the windows. But the main reason them being that size is no emergency escape doors on Viscounts, so you had to be able to exit through the window. So what would happen was if you look at the windows as we can see here, at the top of the window was a flap. There would be a lever behind the flap which you'd pull, two bolts would blow, and the window would drop out. They're not positioned over a wing, they're positioned past there, there's no rubber chute, so you physically jump out of the window onto the ground. Dependent how you've crashed, wheels up, there's not a great jump. Wheels folded under on the front, it's a two-bedroom window jump. So wait until half the aircraft have jumped out. They're like gasping for breath on the floor there, and they make a lovely mattress to land on.
What a great image. There's no way you get that through modern safety rules. I mean, the emergency chute is you open the window and jump out. Yeah. That is just wonderful.
You forget, you've got to say Geronimo as you come.
Geronimo! It is very much a modern-style airplane. So when was this one built?
1958. This was one of the last ones. They prototyped 1948, but they really started working in anger 1951. So we flew for 30 years, 40,000 hours in the air, and 42,210 takeoff and landings in that period.
Wow. Was this aircraft a commercial success?
Yes, probably the most successful aircraft that Vickers built after the war on that. Because it was the world's first turboprop, our friends across the pond didn't have turboprop technology, so the Americans bought from us on that. So it had a distinctive whine, the turbines, and everybody liked it. But then as progress went on, they wanted a bigger aircraft, so the Vanguard came in, not so smooth. Then, after the Vanguard, you got the 111, and then the 146 Whisper Jet on that. But it's a shame. I mean, you can see, looking at the windows, you've got curtains on the windows. You had pleasant food. Unlike the stuff you get nowadays, the whole process was rather nice.
Yeah, but the difference, unfortunately, was that flying was for richer people, wasn't it, mostly?
That's very right. Yes, richer people and a strict dress code, shirt, tie, jacket and trousers for gents.
Really? A dress code for getting onto a passenger aircraft? Yeah. Seriously?
And ladies wore dresses. It was normal, that was accepted, that was what you did, you know, you dressed up. Whereas now, as long as you know the meaning of soap and water, and you've got clothes that cover what they need to cover, and you're not drunk, you'll get on a plane.
Yeah. And what's your background then, before Brooklands Museum?
Well, my background before Brooklands Museum was 35 years in the British Airports Authority, based at Heathrow. So I had sort of various jobs I did. I ended up sort of involved security and then helping out setting up Terminal 4. And that, then I came retired early because a lot of the youngsters coming into the business didn't have common sense and they cost us a lot of money. So I was fed up with sorting them out. So I thought, I'll retire, sit on my backside at home. The wife had other ideas. So for 10 years, I've been down at Brooklands.
So she shook you out of the house. Get out, I've got things to do.
She changed the locks as well. I've never forgiven her for that.
But now you love being a volunteer, I guess.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's sort of Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays. And then the outreach team, which is the promotional side of the museum, where we go around the country doing shows and things like that, I do. We're going down tomorrow to help set up for the Goodwood Revival on that. So it does mean the good lady at home is free from me whinging and saying, can I have a cup of tea and what time's dinner?
So Goodwood Revival's all about cars, of course, rather than planes.
Yes, yes, it's all about cars on there. The thing actually which the museum is involved in, which covers both, we do Wings and Wheels down at Dunsfold, where there's aircraft, there's cars, there's bikes, there's the flying condition VC-10, which we do 85 mile an hour taxi runs up and down the runway on there. We do 8 miles over the weekend and burn £2,000 worth of fuel on that aircraft because that's the home of ex-home of Clarkson from Top Gear.
Ah, we remember that well.
Yes, lovely fella. Couldn't eat a whole one.
Hope he's back on screen again soon. I miss him.
Yes, yes. It's not the same. It's not the same. I mean, Chris Evans was very, very good, but there you've got to admit that between the three of them, they did, you know, bounce off each other very well. And, you know, maybe it might have been a good idea to put it to bed and say it's been good, you know. But if you set up, you've got to make it your own, haven't you? Completely different.
And you're involved with the membership side of things here as well, Mike.
Yes, we do. When we do our outreach teams, we have our tent set up. And people come along and they can take out a membership for an individual or a double or a family, which gives them unlimited entry to the museum for a year, which saves them a lot of money. Or if they really want to push the boat out to sort of £90, that gives them a membership where there's two adults, three children, plus the remaining two adults and three children as well. As many times as you like in. We've got our own restaurant. We do certain events for them. You've got specialised parking for them. So that, a lot of people don't know about, can save them a lot of money with the shows that we do. And we've been very successful in selling, obviously, the upper one because it's got all the benefits that some of the other ones haven't. But you know what it's like when you've got kids, you want to take them out, I want to go to Thorpe Park or I want to go to that. You're looking at sort of £200 to do that. But for the family membership, or the top membership of £90, you can come as many times as you like with your friends. If you don't want to cook Sunday lunch, you can come down Sunday lunch, you know, and do that. And the bar prices are very reasonable.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
And you. I'm on the Concorde bus with Bob Webb, a Concorde steward. Hi, Bob.
Oh, good afternoon. Well, generally what we do is introduce ourselves and explain what we actually do. To give you a general idea, I would explain that we enter the aircraft via the rear stairs, which takes us into the cargo bay. The cargo bay itself has the sort of bulkhead removed, so we can then walk by the way through to the section where the 60 seats would have been. And within that section, there are four video screens showing a DVD of different aspects of Concorde, which obviously they have time to walk around and enjoy. It's just a general, shall we say, little Concorde museum within that area. After a little while, all the four screens go to the same showing, and this showing is of the history of this particular aircraft, one which we call Delta Golf, which was in fact the sixth Concorde to fly. What we show that section in is just the fact that it took quite a bit of, shall we say, expense and trouble to get it here. The aircraft itself first flew in 74 and only flew till 1981, Christmas Eve in actual fact. It landed in Filton and there it lay for quite a few years, and then when we got it back, it was very minimalistic, shall we say. Quite a few of the parts have been removed, which obviously we used for the other Concorde that were in service, and it was used, shall we say, as a spare part idea to keep everything else flying. Then we sort of moved forward to the front section where the 60 seats have been, as we say, in the rear. The 40 seats in the front would then actually be as they would have been in 1993. That's the seats that are present. They put in 1993, that's correct. And there we sit, and then there's a video screen up in front of us, and Mike Bannister, the chief pilot, gives us a little view of how things happen as we take a flight.
Thank you. Now, you said this is the sixth Concorde to be built, and what's its relationship to Brooklands?
Well, the relationship to this aircraft, as in every aircraft Concorde-wise, is that the front section, that's from the nose to the 12th window, that's a bit seat number 5, was built here at Brooklands. Also, the rear section, which was the baggage bay, was also built at Brooklands. The central section, built at Toulouse in France. So for the French aircraft, We would send the nose and tail out to Toulouse, and for the British aircraft, they sent the central section down to Bristol, and then we in turn sent air, front and rear, to Bristol, where it was actually assembled.
The rear of the aircraft is a little tiny wheel miles off the ground. So what's that for?
Oh, that's quite an interesting aspect. Most aircraft, as you'll probably realise, conventional aircraft, fly in a completely different way to the Concorde, a delta wing aircraft. If you travel down the runway, you may notice with your conventional aircraft that as the speed is generated and the lift is also generated, the wings start to bend up a little bit. Unfortunately, Concorde doesn't fly quite like that. All the lift is generated when it really sort of presents itself to the air. And so what actually happens, it takes off at rather a higher speed than the conventional airliner, 250 miles an hour to be precise. The pilot, when reaching that speed, pulls on the stick, the aircraft then noses up, and unfortunately then, he's overzealous, shall we say, also on his landing, because it lands at a very acute angle as well, about 13 degrees. If he's overzealous, he can then smash the back of the engines into the runway. They are slightly lower than a straight line drawn from the wheels to the tip of the tail. And you'd hit the, shall we say, what can we put it this way? But the engineering department are not very happy if you smash the ducts, which are the afterburners, and also the fact that you've got a situation of moving the the back of the engines into a position to reverse the thrust. So they hit the ground first, and that's not a good idea.
Thank you, Bob. So this is the beginning of the Concorde experience, your explanation, and then people go up onto the airplane and enjoy the airplane and the video show, and I won't tell you any more about this. It's something you have to do for yourself. It's a Concorde experience at Brooklyn's Museum. Thank you very much, Bob.
I'm sitting in the Sunbeam Cafe with Lynn Hallam-Pike. Hello, Lynn.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Great, thank you. So, first of all, well, what have you done for your sins that you have to look after all of these people here?
I've been in this industry for such a long time now that it's just in my bones. I love it. I like seeing people happy. I like seeing them enjoying themselves. And best of all, having good catering and experience.
That's great. Now, this is your part of a franchise here, aren't you?
It's separate to the museum. It's Sunbeam Cafe. We're here to offer a service to the people that come to the museum, offering a wide range of dishes, including gluten-free, and we can cater any dietary needs that you may have. You just need to ask us, and we will do what we can for you.
Great. Now, apart from the normal cafe, which is great, because I've tried a few things, and that's fine, you do special services and weddings and all sorts, don't you?
We cater for just about anything here, from weddings to parties to conferences, birthday parties, you name it, we will cater for it. Just need to ask us for details.
Now, Derek did tell me earlier that there's actually been weddings held in the Concorde, and then you do the catering after that?
We certainly do. We even have served champagne under the wing of Concorde. On Concorde, there has been ceremonies on Concorde. We can get our own license to do the weddings upstairs in certain areas. Fantastic Napier room, and also the Bluebird room. If you contact the hospitality staff, they will be able to advise you further.
Great. Now, have there been any very unusual, slightly outrageous, odd sort of events, people in costumes, that kind of thing, that you've had to cater for?
Some of the weddings have had very unusual themes to them. Also, the 1940s event weekend that we have here, everyone dresses for the occasion, including staff. Even the food is appertaining to the era.
What, you mean it's horrible?
No, not at all. We don't do that. We cater properly.
Food from the 1940s, oh dear me, isn't that just spam?
Not entirely, no. No, not entirely. You'd be surprised.
I bet you have some real fun events as well here.
We do. The Children's Weekend is good, the emergency day, where children come in to see Fireman Sam. They are on the engines, the fire engines, the ambulances. They are shown around all the appliances, and they have a fantastic day, and they're just so happy.
That's really nice. And you just like make people happy. That's very clear from what you do.
Thank you. We do.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to talk to you, Lynn.
Thank you.
So, that was my day at Brooklands Museum in Weybridge. I enjoyed it immensely. My thanks to the many volunteers that I met. Try the museum for yourself. It's a great day out.
Brooklands Radio. Loving events in Surrey.